Okay, at the end of the retreat there is the transference of merit. What are the merits to be transferred? Just by sitting there and listening to the Dhamma talk, we have accumulated merits? Question mark. Okay, so how much merit have you accumulated during this retreat? Well, it depends on what you have done during the retreat, yeah? If you have been sitting there in meditation and thinking bad thoughts while meditating, then you haven't made much merit. But if you have been sitting there and you have been developing kindness and compassion and understanding or whatever, as long as you are purifying your mind, you are, in a sense, making merit. This is part of the punya in Pali language, the generosity and sila and bhavana is all punya, because it eventually leads to a better state in the future if you purify yourself. Whenever you do something good, whenever you have a good intention, you are in a sense making good karma and making merit for yourself. So the meditation practice is actually included in that. So everything you have done, hopefully, most things you've done during this retreat will have been a part of increasing your store of good karma. Transferring, the idea of transferring merit, I think the word transfer is not a very appropriate word, because you can't really transfer, because transfer sort of implies that my merit is going down and your merit is going up. If I give my merit to Gerald, he goes up, mine goes down, yeah? But it doesn't work like that. By transferring merit, or by dedicating your merit to someone else, your merit goes up and the other person's merit goes up. That's kind of the nice thing about it. Because the idea of transferring merit is actually in itself a good action. Yeah, I want to share this with you. Yeah, I'm to make this. You think about your parents who have passed away, or some other family member who's passed away, or whatever. And maybe very often, family members, because they are close to you, they have some attachment to you. They may still be around. They may be around as a ghost or whatever. And then when you say, "This is for you, I'm doing this for you," they may actually feel that. And what they feel is very often the intention. Yeah, I'm doing this for you, Mama. And then your mom might be very proud of you. Yeah, she might say, "Wow, that's very kind of you." And then she feels happy. And when she feels happy, if she has been reborn, or your father or whoever it is has been reborn in a state which is not so nice, there are only certain places you can actually achieve the, experience other people's intentions. And the one place you can experience that is in the Peta Loka, the ghosts, the hungry ghost world. That's where you can actually often experience other people's intentions. Why? Because the Peta Loka is very close to us. People are still attached, and they're still kind of around. So when you say something, "May you be happy and well," they may feel that, and then they feel happy. And then when they feel happy, that actually may be enough to make them come out of that particular realm they have been reborn into. Yeah, so it's not really transfer, it's more like a mutual rejoicing in what is going on. You can't transfer your merit. If you have made good merit, you have to live with that. Yeah, you can't give it away. Isn't that good? You can't lose it again once you made it. It's going to carry on with you. That's kind of the good thing about that. So I hope that makes sense. So merit is a very broad idea in the Buddhist teachings. Punya is the Pali word for merit. Boon, they say in Thailand. Thailand, they have this shortened form of everything. Yeah. Boon is punya. Okay, next one. Bhante, when the mind is energized, like you said, nuclearized after the meditation, especially at night, it is very difficult to fall asleep. Is this normal? It is very normal. This is the thing, when your meditation is going well, your amount of sleep you need goes down. You need less and less sleep, and you feel energized all the time, and eventually you sleep only a few hours a night, 3 or 4 hours, and you can't sleep anymore, and you feel perfectly bright and awake throughout the day. So very natural. So if your meditation has been going well, that is exactly what you can expect. Should one forego sleep and ride on this energized mind? Indeed, there's no problem with foregoing the sleep if your mind is energized. Because usually the reason why we sleep is because we're tired. So if you're not tired, no need to sleep. Don't have too much of a preconceived idea of how much you need to sleep. Just kind of go with the flow. And as you go with the flow, you feel what is required. One of the things about the Buddhist middle path is that everything should be done in the right balance, and that includes sleeping. You should sleep the right amount, says the Buddha, which means not too much, not too little. If you sleep too much, you also feel kind of tired, you know, if you sleep too many hours. But these days, most people have a problem of not sleeping enough. That seems to be a kind of modern problem everywhere around the world. Nobody's sleeping enough. Maybe they have too much, you know, too connected to the internet or something. They can't sleep anymore. So these days, it's more important to get enough sleep. Turn off your devices. You know, they say that an hour before you go to bed, turn off all your internet connection. If you can't stop yourself from checking your emails or Facebook or whatever, lock it away, somewhere you can't get access to it. Someone here said to me that one of the problems was they were kind of addicted to, you know, watching YouTube and whatever. So I said to this person, I said, what you should do, give your mobile phone to another person, tell them to hide it and give it back to you next morning. After 7 p.m. or 8 p.m., shut off time. If you, as long as you can access these things, as long as you have access to them, you won't be able to have the willpower to stop. Because human willpower is notoriously weak. Everybody knows it's very weak. So the only way you're going to be able to stop yourself is by, like, tricking yourself, like kind of being smart about it. You have to use wisdom to stop yourself. So you make your mobile phone or whatever it is, you make it inaccessible for certain periods of the day. Very, very interesting. Some of the people who are the most tech-savvy in the world, like, you know, people in Silicon Valley in the U.S., some of the leaders in Silicon Valley, they never buy smartphones for their children, because they know how damaging it can be. So maybe when they become 15 or 16, they might get the smartphone, but not before that, because they understand that these things are problematic. So we need to find that balance in sleep, and sometimes you have to be smart about it to find that balance in your life. Sleep enough, just right, so you feel bright. That's kind of the idea. Same thing with food, with eating. Sometimes people come to a retreat like this, they can't eat in the afternoons. They think, I must eat a lot at lunchtime. And then you eat too much. And then you kind of, you know, you fall asleep in the afternoon and nodding away. You know, it's like kind of you're frightened, you get anxious about not having enough food. But usually it is no problem at all. Once you get used to the idea of not eating in the afternoon, easy. And it's okay. And you have a bit of chocolate. If you feel really hungry, you can come up to my room and knock on the door. And it, because Gerald has all these extra things for me, like a bit of cheese and chocolate. I don't know if what you're getting, but I can give you a little bit of cheese if you feel really hungry. It's too late now. It's the last day today, isn't it? I lost my opportunity to make good karma. Wow, that's a shame. Next year, if you feel really, kind of really, really hungry in the afternoon, you can just knock on my door. If that, you won't come anyway, I know that. But if you have that opportunity, it means that you will eat less at lunch, because you know you always have an opportunity in the evening. That psychological trick is enough to stop you eating too much at lunchtime, you see? That's kind of the point with this. Anyway, so everything in moderation, everything in the right balance, eating, sleeping, even meditation, right amount, not too much. If you do too much, you get fed up. You can't. It is not no fun anymore if you do too much. If you sit all the time, after a while, you get bored. You can't focus on anything because it just seems, so boring, you know, this meditation. So do the right amount that you enjoy. If you go too far, again, it's not going to work for you. Everything has to be done with a degree of wisdom, not according to a set timetable. This is one of the reasons I don't often like things that are too structured. So sometimes you get meditation techniques where everything is bang, 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 structured, one thing after the other. You have 15 minutes of metta, 15 minutes of asubha practice, half an hour of mindfulness of breathing, you walk in meditation for 15 minutes, and then you start from beginning again, do the same thing. Do that for 10 hours a day, sleep 5 hours at night, eat a mealtime at this time, and you do this for 7 days. That's your retreat. There's no flexibility. And when there is no flexibility, because we are all slightly different, it means that you can't adjust according to your own, what is your own natural rhythm. So I believe in more of a free system where we are all responsible for our own practice to a high degree. So we get encouraged by the word of the Buddha or whatever it is. So we find that inspiration to practice enough. But we are not forced to do things. In a group like this, people will be at all different levels. Yeah, some people will not get the meditation together at all. Still, it's nice to come here because you get some, hear the word of the Buddha a little bit. You get to at least test yourself a little bit. Others will get really nice meditation, and we need to cater for all those people with different, different stages on the path. That's kind of the point of this. But it means you have to take more responsibility. That's what it means, really. Yeah. And it's interesting, if you look at the word of the Buddha, the way the Buddha teaches meditation is often not so structured. Yeah, it's not kind of you do A, B, C, D. There's a structure there, but not very structured. And that compares very differently to some of the modern meditation systems that are very kind of very, very structured. So the Buddha was actually much more free in the way he taught. Okay. So, if you want to add anything to what I say, please do so. Yeah, please. Venerables, you want to say something here? Are you sure here? Yeah, I've talked enough already. You can do a bit of talking if you like. Yeah. Absolutely sure. Okay. Respect to Ajahn, when walking meditation, what should we contemplate, breathing or steps? Thank you very much. Okay, so what should you do when you do walking meditation? And the thing about walking meditation is that there is no set thing that you should do. It really depends on the circumstances. You have to feel what feels right. And really what you have to do is you have to know your mind and body in such a way that you do what is appropriate at any one time. Very often when we sit down, that is when we do the samatha part of meditation. We watch the breath and we try to focus on something. We try to reach a state of samadhi. Then when you do walking meditation, I would recommend you to do something different. If you watch your steps, it means that you're continuing trying to reach samadhi. But after a while, the mind kind of has enough of that. If you sit down, you will sometimes find your meditation goes through a cycle. You start off, you get more and more peaceful, and it kind of comes to a plateau, a top, and then you kind of come out of the meditation. That's kind of the natural cycle of meditation very often. So then when you come out, it is not natural to start straight away again with more samatha meditation or more watching the breath. You need a break before you start again. And that break can be walking meditation. That break can be anything really, anything you want. Go for a walk or whatever you want to do, or have a cup of tea even, or it doesn't really matter so much. Listen to a Dhamma talk or whatever. So then, to do walking meditation, do something different. Do like a contemplation, yeah? A very important part of Buddhism is actually contemplating things, contemplating the Dhamma in particular. When we read the suttas, in a sense, what we do, we are contemplating the suttas, trying to extract the meaning, trying to find inspiration in this. What does it actually mean? Who was the Buddha? And as we contemplate this, it starts to become meaningful to us. This is what contemplation is about. You think, okay, who is the Buddha? Okay, he was this man, he was in India, he had this wisdom, he knew everything about happiness and suffering. That's pretty amazing. One person knows everything about happiness and suffering, and he's my teacher. And in this way you kind of inspire yourself, you reflect on these qualities. Reflection on the Buddha is one of the ways of giving rise to piti, this happiness that is absolutely required as a foundation of meditation practice. So it's all there. So this is one thing you can do. Or you can just think about the suttas more generally. What does this mean? How do I apply this in my life? When I go back home, what am I going to do? Some people coming back home is a bit of a shock when you come from a retreat. Even if it is a kind of a relaxed retreat, still, it's when you come back home, it's very different again from being here. So there's one thing you can do. Or you can do other kinds of contemplation. You can do a death contemplation while walking here. Just remind yourself that you could die. Yeah, I could die today. Am I ready to die today? Or if today is too difficult to think, maybe think next week. Because sometimes dying today is too much in your face. But next week, yeah? Or 1 month down the track, I could die. What does that mean? am I ready to die? Like we asked the other day, is there any unfinished business as they like to say? Anything I should say to somebody? Maybe I need to give forgiveness to someone or ask forgiveness, or maybe I need to, you know, say to people some nice or kind words, because I might die. And all of these things, we have a chance. The chance is while we're alive. And if we don't take it while we're alive, it's going to be too late. So that is what death reminds you of, the urgency of doing the right thing now, because the chance may not come back again later on. Death contemplation is very powerful if you do it in the right way. I know that some people like the death contemplation we did the other day. But what it does, it takes away all the nonsense in life. If you are going to die tomorrow, what is going to be your priority? Is it going to be angry with people? Probably not. If you're dying tomorrow, you don't want to be angry with anyone. You want to kind of get that out of the way. Are you going to desire a lot of things in this world if you're going to die tomorrow? It's crazy to desire things that belong to this world if you're going to die tomorrow. So that reflection, if you do it right, if you really think, I could actually die today. You don't know what illnesses you have inside of you. Yeah, heart attack, just waiting to come out. Yeah, it's still beating. Okay, still beating. Good. Cancer, I'm sure all of us probably have cancer cells in our body already. They're just waiting for the time to kind of come out. They're given the right conditions. I'm sure you have some bad drivers in Hong Kong, like everywhere. So you walk down the street and whack, you're finished. Or you kind of stumble somewhere, you fall over and you die. People die in the strangest ways. And it's not just the old people who die, middle-aged people die, young people die, babies sometimes die. So it is never wrong. Death is never wrong. People think, oh, it's not the time yet because I'm too young. You're never too young to die. Death can happen at any time. So death contemplation is very useful if you do it in the right way. It takes away the silliness and the nonsense of life, and it gets you to focus on those things that really matter. So you can do this in your walking meditation. So contemplate the Dhamma, do specific contemplations like death contemplation. You can do metta while you do walking meditation. Are there some people that you have problems with? How can I forgive these people? Everyone, most of us sometimes need to forgive others and forgive ourselves. How can I forgive this person? Try to understand their perspective. There is a nice French saying. I don't know why the French said this, but the French said something like, I don't know who said it, some fairly wise person, I suppose. And this person said that to understand everything is to forgive everything. If you understand fully where another person is coming from, why they are doing what they're doing, in other words, you understand their conditioning fully, you can forgive them. You can forgive them because you know why they did that. You know it wasn't really purposeful, it was because of the conditioning or whatever. So to understand all is to forgive all. So try to understand other people. Why are they doing this? And of course, the reality is they weren't really trying to hurt us. They were just doing things because of their own conditioning. You can do that while you do walking meditation. Another thing you can do when you do walking meditation, this was a monk I mentioned him the other day called Utejaniya, famous Burmese monk. Have any of you heard of Utejaniya? Burmese monk in one of the main meditation traditions in Myanmar. And he said to his disciples, when you do walking meditation, don't do anything, just walk back and forth. Walk. And what he teaches is watching your mind. So as you walk back and forth, all you do is just be aware of the content in your mind. And in a sense, that already teaches you a lot about yourself. Sometimes we don't know ourselves all that well because we are so rushing around, don't really have the time to see our own minds clearly. So you get to know yourself. What are my problems? What are my defilements? And you can see the causes, the thing that lead to defilements in your mind. What are the people I'm having problems with? Where are my desires? What are the things I need to sort out? Especially problems with other people, anger, that kind of stuff. You see it playing out in your mind. Then you start to understand what is going on. Then you can do a countermeasure. Or when you do walking meditation, you can just walk back and forth and enjoy the peace. You've been sitting on your bottom, trying to watch your breath, and maybe you're tired of that for a while. And now just allow the mind to wander a little bit. Enjoy the peace. Focus on the peace. And just allow your mind to enjoy that and rest in that. And then after a while, you may feel ready to come back and sit down again and do some more breath meditation. Yeah? Back and forth. All of these things are valid. You can also watch the movement of your feet, but remember that is more like a samatha practice. You can do that if you want to. So if you don't like to watch the breath, you can do samatha while walking instead. Just follow the feeling in your feet as your feet touch the ground. Yeah, and then feel the foot lifting up and touching ground. And the next foot, back and forth like that. Almost as if you're watching the breath, yeah? One step at a time, trying to see the whole process of walking like that. That is also okay. You can do so many things. It's just, you know, it's really up to you. Know your mind. Know what you need at any particular time. And then you can make the best decisions on how to do the walking meditation. Are you happy with that? I don't know who you are, but whoever you are you happy? Yeah, I don't have to say who you are, but just, yeah, okay, good, I'm glad. I'm not sure if you're tired or happy, but anyway, I'll leave it at that. Good, okay. Dear Ajahn, in the practice of samatha meditation, it is about letting go of the body and thoughts and passively observe the object of meditation. Is the technique for metta meditation different in that the meditator is to evoke the feelings of wellness and happiness and then radiating out to sentient beings? Grateful for your comments. It is a little bit different, but in really when it comes down to it, it is the same idea. Yeah, so you, in samatha meditation, you have a little bit, you try to be peaceful. You use your mind a little bit initially just to feel the peace, just to kind of observe in the right way, to, appreciate what you're doing or whatever. There's maybe a tiny bit of movement there in activity, but as little as possible. In metta meditation also, we don't really do all that much. You focus on this idea of other beings. You see the good qualities in other beings. Metta arises when you see the good qualities in other people. Yeah, you have metta towards people who have good qualities. It's kind of quite natural. So you bring to mind this idea of all these good qualities, and you see all the beings with those qualities. You almost like you project those qualities all onto all the beings in another direction, and you know that there are lots of good people out there, lots of good devas and all of these kind of things. You know that already, because this is how the world is. And then that's really all you have to do. And then you kind of allow that perception in your mind, and then you wish them well, coming from your heart. Yeah, you have to really mean these things. If you don't mean it, it's not going to work. You really wish them well. May you be well. You deserve happiness. You have all these wonderful qualities. And then when you wish them well, that's all you do, and then you wait. You stay with the perception in your mind. You don't actually move. You don't go anywhere else. Stay with that perception in your mind. And then the idea is for the feeling to come. Once the feeling arises, you can actually just focus on the feeling here. Stay with the feeling here. And if it is the right time, the feeling will then expand. And then you will move towards samadhi that way. Or if that doesn't work, when the feeling comes, you can then take that feeling and go with the breath. That's also another possibility here. You can kind of join these things a little bit. So don't, when you do the metta meditation, don't do too much activity. Don't keep saying, may you be well, may you be well, may you be well, may you be well all the time. If you say too much activity here, say it once. And then just stay with that one saying and feel that. What does it feel like? Stay with that. Stay with that. It's just a perception, seeing these beings out there. Stay with it. And then if it doesn't work, then after a while you change direction and you think about it in a slightly different way. Yesterday, what I tried to do, I tried to look at this metta in slightly different ways. Every time I go to a new direction, I try to give slightly different directions. Yeah, say something, try something slightly different. And then if you get it, one of those may work for you, the other ones may not work. And then you have some idea which aspect of metta works for you. Yeah, so you try that. And then after a while, if that works for you, then after a while it stops working. Yeah, let's say it works for you for a few days or a few weeks or whatever, and then it stops working because these are instruments that become blunt, if you like. Yeah, so you try this, but when the mind gets habituated to certain things, after a while it doesn't work anymore because it doesn't have that novelty and power that it had initially. So then you have to be creative and do things slightly differently and give rise to it in a different way. So everything, things have a tendency to work for a while and then they stop working. And then after a while they come back again, they start working again. This is how often it will be. Okay, so I hope that helps. And you just have to be quite persistent and keep on going. And then as you do so, you will eventually have some success in that meditation. Do you want to come back on that question at all, or are you okay with that one? Okay, good. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teaching in the past few days. We have basically practiced meditation with the eyes closed. Is it okay to let the eyes softly open? If you want to, can do that. If you want to have them kind of slightly open, if you find that is helpful for, you know, I don't know, for maybe for whatever reason, you can do that. And if you then find that your mind becomes peaceful, then after a while it is very likely you will want to close your eyes completely, because the visual input is often disturbing if your mind becomes very peaceful. Don't want to have any visual input after a while. But if it is good to start out, you can. Even when you do walking meditation, sometimes you can become very peaceful. Yeah, it's possible to become really peaceful. Adam Brahma always tells how peaceful he became in walking meditation. So he had all this joy and happiness and all these weird things happening. Because when your eyes are open, weird stuff happens when the mind becomes peaceful. Yeah, so he tells the story of when he was in Thailand. And in Thailand, he was one of the first monks to move to Wat Nanachat. Wat Nanachat is like the international forest monastery near Ajahn Chah's monastery in the northeast of Thailand. So they, Ajahn Chah decided, okay, we're going to have a... There were so many foreigners coming to Ajahn Chah, mostly from a Western background, also some Japanese, all kind of foreigners coming together, some from Malaysia, I think. And so he said, okay, you, all the foreigners, you start your own monastery here, Not sure why, maybe he was fed up with the foreigner, maybe he couldn't talk to them. I'm not sure why, but foreigners, okay, out. You start your own monastery here. So they started their own monastery. It became known as Wat Nanachat. First it was known as Wat America, something like that, because most of the monks were American. But after a while, it was very international. So Nanachat, Nana means many, and Chat is nationality or something like that. So many nationalities. So they started this monastery, and all the things in the monastery were built by the villagers. And the local villagers, they are rice farmers, They're all rice farmers, that's how they kind of survive. They don't know much about building work. So they, one of the things they were going to do, they built the concrete floor in the meditation hall. And Ajahn Brahma said, this is the worst concrete floor he's ever seen. It's like this. Maybe something like that. It's absolutely not flat. And they had to sit on this concrete floor. So painful to sit on. In those days, no cushions, just sit straight on the concrete, because cushions were considered like a luxury item in those forest monasteries. Imagine, that was pretty tough, in those days. You had to be really tough to kind of to deal with that. And for the local people, maybe it was okay because they wasn't used to anything. But if you came from the West, you're used to sitting on a chair or whatever, and suddenly now you had to sit on the concrete floor, it would have been very difficult, and your knees were hurting and everything was hurting. I can imagine being very, very hard. But anyway, Ajahn Brahma was incredibly tough when he was young. He had very good meditation, so it went very easily, even though the concrete floor was so terrible, still he could endure it, because he would just kind of go inside of himself and he wouldn't feel anything, so he'd be okay. But then he said he would also do walking meditation on this concrete floor. And when he does walking meditation, because his mind becomes so still, all the joy and happiness comes up, and all these shapes and colors just come flashing out of the concrete. The concrete looks like this kaleidoscope of colors and shapes and all kind of stuff. And that's what happens. It's not because the concrete has that color. It is the mind creates that because the peace is so powerful. So Ajahn Brahm said, I've never seen such beautiful concrete in my entire life. This concrete is more beautiful than anything else. More beautiful than the forest, more beautiful than everything. So ever since then, he has loved concrete. And what that means in our monastery, it means that Ajahn Brahm wants concrete everywhere. And the monks say, please, no more concrete. And Ajahn said, no, we have to have a bit more concrete here. Concrete road. Those of you who have been to our monastery know we have concrete roads. They're sneaking around the monastery everywhere. I think we should go in the Guinness Book of Records for the monastery with the most concrete roads. Will you make an application, Geralda? You can make an application to the Guinness Book of Records for us. So there's a conflict in our monastery between all the other monks on the one hand, Ajahn Brahm on the other hand, kind of fighting over how many concrete roads we should have. Yeah, this is kind of one of the problems. But Ajahn Brahm has this very beautiful perception of concrete. Concrete, whoa, so beautiful. Most people like trees. Ajahn Brahm likes concrete. That's the difference. So that is the story of Vatnanachara. I'm not sure where I start. I lost my train of thought now. Where did we start from? I can't remember anymore now. Anyway, so that is just a little story about the early days and Ajahn Brahm's, what happens in meditation, can happen in meditation practice. So let's go on to the next question here. Dear Ajahn, if we are being verbally attacked by others, being defamed and badmouthed, spread rumors, should we remain silent or voice out? If we remain silent, people misunderstand and think we think the untrue is true. If we remain silent, are we being kind to them? Okay, this is a good question. And if you are being verbally attacked by others, or defamed, or bad mouth and bad rumors are being spread, you should defend yourself. It is okay to defend yourself. Yeah, Buddhism is not, that doesn't mean kind of lying down and allowing everyone to drive over you. That's not really the Buddhist idea. You can defend yourself. But remember, the point is not, that is not the point in Buddhism. The point is how we defend ourselves. Try to do it in the right way. A lot of the bad things that you hear in your life, you can't do anything about. You know, if you, every day people may say bad things and you can just drop most of that. But if it is a serious case like this that you're talking about here, where people are attacking you or whatever, then you really should defend yourself. You should say, this is not true for this or this reason or whatever, and put it forward. But you try to do it with in a kind of balanced way, without getting too agitated, without getting too upset about it. This is the tricky part. If you can do it in the right way, it's always okay to defend yourself. So all you have to do is just to remember that if someone is doing all these bad things to you, they are the person who have the problem. Yeah, okay, you are going to have some negative consequences of that, but really they are the person who has the problem, and they are the ones who will suffer in the future because of that. And this happened also at the time of the Buddha. And there were people who were saying bad things about the Buddha and the monastic community. The Buddha would say to the monks, oh, just don't worry about it. This will only last a few days and then it will die down and disappear. And that's usually what happens. Sometimes if you just allow things to be and you don't worry about it, after a while people just leave you alone because they know they can't really manipulate you. You're not really able to do anything with you, so because they can't manipulate you, they just let you go. Sometimes that happens, especially perhaps with the Sangha and with the Buddha, because there was a lot of purity there, so people could see that these rumors were just bad people saying bad things. But sometimes it may not be as easy as that. Sometimes you may have to defend yourself if things are persistent, or if it is with people who you have to deal with on a regular basis or something like that. So defend yourself. Yeah, do what you need to do, but try to do it with kindness. If eventually nothing works, then maybe you have to kind of even break off that relationship a little bit, if that's possible, if that can be done. Sometimes you have to distance yourself a little bit from people who are too difficult, just to protect yourself. Metta to others does not mean putting yourself in a position where you can be hurt. We have to look after ourselves. It's a very important principle in Buddhism. Metta also goes towards ourselves. So if other people are really hurtful and difficult, withdraw a little bit. go your own way and just leave them alone. Don't worry about them. No need to be angry with them, but just understand, is it too difficult to deal with this right now? I'm going to withdraw a little bit. Yeah, so if we are remaining silent, are we being kind to them? And sometimes it is not kind to remain silent, yeah, because sometimes when you remain silent, they don't learn. And sometimes when you speak up, you know, people sometimes may learn things, and they may actually grasp that there is a problem here. What should we do anyway? There's another interesting point. What should we do if other people criticize us? That's one of those interesting things, because we always get some degree of criticism in life. Everybody gets criticized every now and again. What does the Buddha have to say about this? And what the Buddha says is that if someone criticizes you, what you should do, you should ask yourself, is there any truth to this? Yeah. Usually if someone criticizes us, we kind of reject it straight away. We don't want to hear it. But the appropriate way of doing it is to ask yourself, is there any truth to this criticism? Of course, if someone else is angry, then usually the reason they criticize us is because they're angry. So then we can usually reject it. But especially when someone is coming from neutrality or even kindness, we should especially ask ourselves whether there might be some truth to the criticism. And if there is truth, then we act accordingly. Maybe we need to change a little bit. If it is untrue, we can just reject it. And one of the nice little verses in the Dhammapada is where the Buddha says that if someone criticizes you or someone points something out to you, like a problem in your conduct, it is like someone pointing out a treasure. Yeah, isn't that kind of radical? If someone points out a problem in your conduct, it's like someone pointing out a treasure to you. Why is that? And the reason is because sometimes we can be blind to our own problems. Because the problems are so close to us, we can't see ourselves clearly. Sometimes it takes an external person to see a problem that we have. But because we are trying to purify ourselves, because we are trying to mine this mind of gold. Yeah, this one sutta I didn't read out, which is it doesn't matter, you can do it at another time, assuming I come back. Maybe I will come back, maybe do that one next year. So now you have a good reason to come back next year, yeah? So, when we refine this mind, if you want to achieve that goal, if you want to find the gold inside of you, you have to actually refine the gold properly. And to be able to do that, you have to see the defilements. You have to see the defilements in the gold, get rid of them. We have to see the defilements in the mind to get rid of that. Only then will the gold come out. And that is why when someone points out a real flaw in your character, they're actually pointing to a treasure. Because it gives you the opportunity to mine the gold inside, and the diamonds and the brightness and the beauty inside of you. That is why. So that is the right attitude. It's a difficult attitude to have because it is natural to become a bit defensive if people point things out to us. But okay, so maybe you become defensive straight away. But afterwards you think, maybe do they have a point or not? And if you can't see a point, let go. 90% of the time you can just let it go because you know it's just nonsense. But occasionally someone will say something useful. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for coming to Hong Kong to give us such an inspiring talk. We are so blessed to have you here. Okay, I'm glad to hear that, so thank you for that. Regarding the talk this morning, Anapanasati, do we have to guide ourselves into focusing on the breath, the rapture experience, the mind, etc., or everything will just come naturally? Things will tend to come naturally. This is actually what happens when you let go. This is what letting go is all about, is that the mind tends to move in this direction. Yeah, and if it doesn't happen, it is because the preliminary steps are not strong enough yet. That is where we should really put our effort into the preliminary steps, how we live our ordinary life, and how we start off the meditation retreat, and then the rest normally should come as a consequence of that. So one of the main reasons why we know these things, one of the main reasons why the Buddha teaches this is that so we have a map. We know that we're heading in the right direction. Yeah, this is the reason. So, for example, if something starts to go a little bit wrong because of a defilement or because of whatever, then you can bring it back on track again, or you can do it slightly differently. If you don't have a map, it's very hard to know where we are or where we're heading, and whether we're developing in the right way. This is one of the main reasons the Buddha gives these things. And also, sometimes you can do, you can nudge the mind a little bit. You kind of give it a bit of a nudge and say, okay, now, a bit of happiness now, okay, so what do I need to do? Okay, you do this, you think in a certain way, and you give it a nudge. But the nudge should be very gentle, because the peace is very easy to disturb. And if the peace is disturbed, it can be difficult to come back again. So very gentle with yourself, and then it comes automatically. And this, in a way, is the beauty of meditation practice, that is so incredibly natural. You just sit back, you wait, you are patient, you have a little bit of the right attitude, you have a kind of an outlook that accords with the Buddha's teachings, and the process just happens. You sit back. And if it doesn't happen, well, now you know why. It's because you need to do more effort outside of meditation, at the beginning of meditation. That's why it doesn't happen.
Not in meditation.
That is the wrong time to make the effort. Okay. Last question. Okay. So, dear Ajahn, can you elaborate more on how to cultivate the mindfulness before observing breath during meditation? Thanks a lot. How to cultivate the mindfulness before observing the breath during meditation? Okay. So, to do that, you have to understand what are the obstacles to mindfulness, yes? And the two main obstacles to mindfulness is that you have either ill will or you have desire. And these things, sometimes these things can be very subtle. When I say ill will, I don't necessarily mean that you are, you know, you are enraged or anything like that. It can be quite subtle little things. Desires too can be very subtle. So it can be subtle things, and the way that you know that there is a problem is that the mind is still a little bit restless. Yeah, it is moving a little bit, thinking about things. Thinking is a sign that there is some desire or ill will in the mind. That's why you think about things. The mind is restless. So to overcome this, one of the most powerful ways, and this is why we talk about the idea of right attitude all the time, is because you want to find that joy in the meditation practice. The joy becomes the glue that glues the mind onto the meditation object. So this is what joy does. And joy counteracts the hindrances, because it is opposite to the hindrances. If you are joyful, you're not going to be interested in all those worldly pleasures. If you're joyful, ill will also is pretty much gone. So you try to find that peace and that joy often coming together. This is why when you sit down, you feel a bit of gratitude. You try to experience the peace around you. And as you do that, those memories and things that have to do with desires and ill will, they kind of fade away. But in the long run, if you have if you have a lot of problem with these things, you have to contemplate the ill will. You have to contemplate the problems and try to overcome them by forgiveness, by seeing people in a different way. And that was that whole sutta I was talking about before, that you have to contemplate to do this, to eliminate that. So mindfulness, the two enemies of mindfulness are desire and ill will. If you read the right effort, how right effort is defined, one of the factors of right effort is called sense restraint. And the way sense restraint is defined in the suttas, it's defined as you guard the mind in such a way that you don't actually give rise to abhijja domanassa. Abhijja is desire, domanassa is something like ill will or an aversion in the mind. This is what it is about. So this is how you guard the mind. This is called sense restraint. So you avoid abhijja domanassa. How do you do that? Well, you do it by having a bit of mindfulness in the first place, and then seeing how you react to the world around you, and then you avoid that reaction by thinking in a different way. And that is what I was taught. This all the whole sutta was about how to learn how to think about other people, not to give rise to resentment. That was what all that was about. So that is why the path is sequential. Start off with all the all the virtues, then the sense restraint, the right action, the right effort, and then comes mindfulness as a consequence. So these are some of the ways that mindfulness kind of gradually comes up. You need a bit of mindfulness to begin with. You all have a little bit of mindfulness. So you start by avoiding anger at any time in your life, because anger is always so destructive. So you start off by doing that. And as you do that, as you have less anger and ill will, mindfulness becomes stronger. When mindfulness becomes stronger, it enables you to let go of even more of these negative emotions. Then mindfulness becomes stronger again. Yeah? So this gradual incremental growth in mindfulness. But don't expect your mindfulness to be very strong during ordinary life. It's actually quite hard to have strong mindfulness in ordinary daily activities. Yeah, suddenly you're completely lost, you don't know what's going on, and suddenly you get upset about something. You can't expect that. So what you should aim for in your ordinary life is to have enough mindfulness to make sure that your conduct is good, yeah? That you live according to the five precepts, you live according to kindness, you live according to minimize your ill will and all these kind of things. If you have enough mindfulness to do that, then congratulations, you're already on the right track. That is the most important thing here. So that is what you should aim for. So if you do a little bit of meditation practice in your daily life, do enough meditation just to have a sense of balance in your mind, a bit of metta, a bit of peace, to balance you out a little bit in the ordinary life, and then you will be on the right track. There is no more questions in here, but what I would like to... Actually, maybe I should ask you first of all, any more questions? Any kind of urgent questions? You may never see me again, right? So this is your chance. This may be the last time. So this is your opportunity. Okay, it's good. Sometimes the question has to be the right for the right time. You never know. But, you know. Everyone, is it because you're happy? Because you're feeling a bit dull after the meal? Or is it because of both of those? Okay, it doesn't matter. That's good. You have many opportunities to ask questions anyway. But I always like to give people the opportunity to ask questions, because sometimes, you know, when you ask something, it is something that you're interested in. When I talk, I have no idea whether you're interested, but when you ask a question, I can be pretty sure you have an interest. That's kind of the advantage of that. But what I would like to do just to finish off is to give you some very brief advice on how to sustain, what to do in daily life, how to keep going. Because when you go back, you get the shock of coming back to your ordinary life again. Actually, it may be no shock at all, maybe it'll be perfectly easy for you, I don't know. But what you will find is that the Dhamma is much more powerful when you are on a retreat like this. You remember it, it's in your face all the time. You have no choice but to hear the Dhamma. I don't know, unless you have been kind of sleeping all day, but presumably you have been coming out, and you've been part of this. So how do we sustain this in our ordinary life? And the first thing to know is that you cannot really sustain it fully. It's impossible. In ordinary life, it's going to be different. Actually, we call that world ordinary life. I think this life is probably more ordinary, because this is more real. The kind of rest of life is more like a blur, you kind of run through everything. This is more real right here. So I'm not sure which one we should call ordinary life, but anyway. So how do we sustain? And one of the things I was saying before, sometimes there's only a few things that you need to remember. And there's one thing that you need to remember in your life, and that is the idea of kindness. Because kindness encompasses all of these things that we call virtue. It encompasses not doing the bad things, and it encompasses doing the good things, including generosity. But it also encompasses how we use our minds. It encompasses the idea of not being angry. It encompasses the idea of being compassionate and kind, mentally as well. So kindness is this broad category that actually includes so many aspects of how we live our life, how we look at other people, all of these kind of things. So remember that one word, remember kindness in your life. And if you can remember that much, that is really all you need. And then you will go a very long way. If you take that seriously, if you really commit to that and really persevere with that, it's going to take you a long, long way. But what happens when you forget about kindness? guaranteed you will forget about it, right? It's absolutely guaranteed, because life gets so busy and suddenly, oops, what happened? Oh, I forgot about kindness. So how can we ensure that we always get back on track again, and we actually are reminded about these things? And to be able to do that, one of the most important things is to have a regular spiritual input in your life. Listen to Dhamma talks that you know have a reasonably good quality. Read a little bit of the word of the Buddha. Listen to a sutta reading from somewhere. Read the sutta for yourself. Whatever it is, read a verse in the Dhammapada. Dhammapada, beautiful little verses sometimes. Really, really inspiring. Yeah, and do these things. And as you do that, you remind yourself on a regular basis of what is actually important in life, what matters. And as you do that, you will be able to keep that sense of kindness in your heart, and you will keep on being able to practice that in the long run. Then you will have a chance to persevere. Then you will have a chance to commit to the practice fully. And this idea is the idea of the Kalyana Mitta. Kalyanamitta, the noble friend or the spiritual friend, yeah? And one of the suttas, I think I may probably mention this year last, I probably mention it every year, but one of the suttas that I haven't read out this year is a sutta where the Buddha shows how awakening happens through a series of conditions, yeah? So awakening happens, the immediate preceding condition is the seven factors of awakening here. You develop those, then awakening happens. What is the cause for the seven factors of awakening? The four satipatthanas. What is the cause for that? The three kinds of good conduct. What is the cause for that? And the Buddha goes back and back and back through a link, 11 links. I'm not going to tell them all to you because it gets too much. He goes back to the root cause. The root cause for awakening. The most important thing at the very bottom. What is that? Kalyanamitta. Spiritual friendship. Why is that? And the reason for that is because we are all conditioned. Yeah? Our conditioning is very, very strong. It comes from lives far, far back in time. We don't know what it is. And because our conditioning is so strong, we are like these boats on the ocean. The boat without a steering mechanism. We don't have a rudder. There's no oars. There's no sail. There's no engine. We are completely dependent on the cause and conditions around us. When the wind comes from the north, our boat goes to the south. When the current comes from the east, our boat goes to the west. And this is what we are as human beings. We are like boats on the ocean, completely dependent on the circumstances around us. We drift around, with no rudder, no steering mechanism inside of us, no self that decides where we should be going. And because of that, we are 100% dependent on where we are going, on that wind, yeah, that blows us. So we make sure that we get into the right wind. Yeah, so if we want to go to the south because that is where happiness is, we should make sure we get the northern wind at all times. What is that northern wind? It's the teaching of the Buddha. That is the condition, that is the cause that drives us towards nibbana, towards happiness. Without that, we're going to be going like this, not going anywhere, no idea where we're going. This is the idea of Kalyanamitta, and that is why Kalyanamitta is said to be the foundation of everything else on the Buddhist path. Without that, there is nothing. There's nowhere to go. We are completely at a loss because we have no ability to see these things without someone to see these things for us. The Buddha is called the eye of the world. And there is a reason for that, because he has made that breakthrough, and then he passes on the information to the rest of us. So this is the beauty of this. This is the idea of the Kalyanamitta. So you need that regular input, from the outside. So make sure you get that regular input. And when, as you get that regular input, you will be able to sustain. You will be able to commit. You will be able to persevere on this path. And then when you come back next year, are you coming back next year? Yeah? Okay. I'm not going to hold you to it. Whatever happens, yeah. If you come back next year, if you go on some other retreat, whatever happens, you will then be able to compare, and you will hopefully see that you have gone a little bit further. Why? Because you've had the regular input, the regular conditioning, and pushing you in the right direction. The conditioning which reminds you of this one word, kindness. With kindness, you're going to go a long way on this path. So, okay. I don't want to talk anymore. I talked enough. I don't want to talk anymore, did I? Okay, can I? No, I'm being naughty. So I think that's all. I don't think there's anything more to add. Does anyone else want to say anything or make any comments? Or Venerable, you want to say anything? Yeah. Would you like to add any good advice to everyone? Yeah. I have been... Would you say anything? Your turn. Okay, you can say something.
Yes?
You don't want to say anything? Yeah. No? Okay, don't want to say anything. That's okay. Don't have to say anything. Yeah. So, anyway, sometimes it's nice to hear someone else's voice rather than hearing my own voice all the time, but that's okay. So, what do we do now, Della? Blessing? Yeah, okay. Offering something? Okay. And what about sharing a merit? Is it last? Sharing a merit, sir? Okay. So, we will do that now, huh? Yeah. And again, the idea of sharing of merits, the way we do that is just to remind yourself of all the people in your life that matter to you, your parents, your relatives, anyone else. And then we will share the merits with them. Wish them well wherever they are. And we'll do this in the traditional Sri Lankan style of sharing merits. So you can just follow me and say these words if you know them. Some of you will know them already. And if not, just kind of join in kind of mentally or whatever. Idang menyati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang menyati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang menyati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so that is sharing the merit with all our departed relatives. And now I will give you just a quick blessing. And this we can pay the respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha at the very end. And this blessing is just well wishing. Yeah, and just wishing you well for your practice and everything. This is a kind of a traditional Buddhist blessing.
Nati me saranang anyang buddho me saranang varang ete na sacchavaje na sotite hotu sambada Nati me saranang anyang dhammo me saranang varang ete na sacchavaje Na soti te otu sabada Na ti me saranang anyak Sango me saranang varang Ete na sachavaje Na soti te otu sabada
Okay, everyone, so that is it as far as I'm concerned. So I wish you all well. Good luck with the practice. And if things come together right there, maybe I'll see you again here next year. And I'll pass over to who? To Gerald? To Della? Do this one first? Yeah? Okay, we'll do this one first so people can go whenever they want. Okay, so we'll do the homage to the triple jam.